اهلا يا شهر رمضان شرفنا بلا استئذان، اهلا يا شهر رمضان شرفنا بلا استئذان، بلك باب القلب مفتوح اهلا يا زكاة الروح، بلك باب القلب مفتوح اهلا يا زكاة الروح، اهلا يا شهر رمضان.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد،
اللهم صل
على محمد وآل محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. So, brothers and sisters, a few points. One of them I should mention before I actually start tonight's lecture. That is that it was mentioned briefly that inshallah we'll be doing one of those marriage workshops. So inshallah, hopefully, if I get a chance, if Allah gives tawfiq, I'd like to give all of us some reminders, some of the things that the Ahlul Bayt, we find in Quran and Sunnah, advice on how to stay married and be successful in our marriages. It's always good for us to invest that time in our marriage, to hear these reminders again, things we may have heard before. Once we've been married a few years, sometimes the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt make a lot of sense to us, and we start to accept them. Now, the way it's been structured, normally I would do this course over 8 hours. In other communities where I'll go, for instance, we'll do it over 2 weekends. 2 hours and then 2 hours. We're not going to do that this time. It's not going to be televised. The revolution will not be televised. It'll just be those of us sitting more of a classroom environment, inshallah. And then hopefully, one of the reasons for mentioning it to the brothers in addition to the sisters is that hopefully couples can attend it together. That would be best if brothers and sisters were both able to attend together. And here's some of the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, advice from the Imams, Quran and Sunnah. Very useful. Because of that, keeping that in mind, on Friday we'll only do 1 hour. So the brothers and sisters would both be able to attend, inshallah, and then Saturday where we've got a little bit more time, we try and take care of it then. That's one point about that. The second point was about verse number 20. So we discussed verse number 20 last time. Verse number 20 was this: وَجَاءَ أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَجَاءَ رَجُلٌ مِنْ أَقْصَى الْمَدِينَةِ يَسْعَى. A man came running from the outskirts of the city. قَالَ يَا مُوسَى. He spoke to Musa. He called Musa. إِنَّ الْمَلَأَ يَأْتَمِرُونَ بِكَ. The elite, the council, the chiefs, they're plotting against you. ليقتلوك. They want to kill you. So leave. فخرج إني لك من الناصحين. That I want what's best for you. I'm one of your well-wishers. So please leave. Now there was a point that I felt that we needed that could be added over here, which I feel is relevant. And it's a little bit about Islamic leadership skills. Some points that we can get from Islamic leadership skills from this part. But before we do that, one other thing that slipped my mind is the discussion the other day that I was saying about the military or the police or working for the government in general and living here in a society which is not Islamic. So I mentioned before that there were two conditions. One of those conditions was that it not cause fasad, corruption, if I want to work. And the other one is that I not be committing any sort of haram act by doing that. So, one of the brothers brought to my attention that, for instance, in order to join the military, and you brothers and sisters, anybody who's thinking about doing that, and they might say, oh, the Sheikh said it's okay, right? If we're going to think about doing that, for instance, one of the things that they have in the military is they have communal bathing. Everybody takes showers together, right? And that's forbidden in Islam. We're not allowed to do that. So, we're not going to say, okay, well, no, intrinsically, some of these occupations, intrinsically, they don't have a problem, but because of the facade, the corruption, the haram that's going to come about, we don't make any justifications. We're Muslims, our rizq comes from Allah. We know that many times, actually, they look for those who are underprivileged to try and get them to sign those contracts and then rush them off, right? When it comes to the military, for instance. So I'm not encouraging anybody to go over and do that. I was just explaining the fiqhi ruling. But some of these things, by the way, the police academies, we learned that the police academies in some places are the exact same way, in addition to the haram that goes on, right? So I'm not advising anybody to ignore any of those rulings. I was just explaining the fiqhi ruling. So now, the point about Islamic leadership and leadership skills. And I feel this is something that applies to all of us, because all of us, in our own way, have a circle of influence. People who listen to us. A responsibility, as we learn from some of the ahadith, towards others. Right? One of the beautiful ahadith, it says, "Kullu nafsin min bani Adam sayyid." That every soul, every member of the human race, in reality is a sayyid, is a leader, has a position, right? And then it says, for instance, what's the position of a man in his house? فَالرَّجُلْ سَيِّدُ أَهْلِهِ. The man's supposed to be in charge of his house. He's a leader of his house. What about the woman? وَالْمَرْأَةُ سَيِّدَةُ بَيْتِهَا. She has a position of leadership inside her house, right? So all of us, point being that all of us have these roles. There's people who listen to us, people who are affected by us, and we want to make sure that we're following our Islamic responsibilities in this regard. What was the lesson then that we could learn from this verse? One of the lessons is the idea of not micromanaging and having strong advisors. Having strong advisors. Remember, Musa alayhi salam is that leader who everybody is expecting to come in and save the society, Musa. One of the mu'mineen comes to him and gives him that information that, by the way, they're plotting against you, but he feels he can express this to Musa. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He feels that he can express this to Musa. He doesn't feel that Musa is so far above him. I can't share my ideas. I can't contribute. I feel something is necessary. I go over, I share it, and then you're the person who's in charge at the time. You make your best decision, right? So that point of us, you know, they have a hadith that say why Musa was chosen. Hadith. Musa is asked by Allah. He said, "Do you know why it is that I chose you to speak to you, chose you to be a Rasul, to have this position?" And he says, "Allah, I don't know why." God says in this hadith, he says, "Inni ittala'tu ila al-ard." I looked on the earth. "Falam ajid 'alayha ashadda tawadhu'an li mink." I didn't find anybody on the face of the earth who was more humble towards me. This is a little different than maybe what we've learned in some of leadership courses that we've taken, the idea of being humble. That's what God chooses, those people who are humble, and makes them leaders, makes them in charge, puts them in charge. Nobody more humble than Musa, and God chooses him out of everybody. So because a lot of times our positions of leadership will be in these Islamic situations, right? Then we should all be working on our humility. One of the benefits of humility, of seeing myself, as we learned from the ahadith, that being a leader is actually being a servant. Sayyidul qawm khadimuhu. As opposed to the ego trip, being a leader means I'm there to serve. I'm there to serve other believers. I'm a father, for instance. I'm there to serve my wife, my children. God has given me this authority to serve them, literally. I see myself as being a servant. I'm a mother. I'm there to serve my children. Right? All of us, we have these roles, but the idea of humility, what comes with his humility is that those who are around us feel easier to express their opinions. They can tell us if they see that something is wrong, a mistake is happening, an area for us to improve. Now, I mentioned this because yesterday I mentioned how important it was for us to have Islamic schools, and that we want to all be thinking about that, bettering those schools. We all have a lot to offer, right? So sometimes, for us, those of us who are involved, who are doing work, we can learn from both parts of the verse. If we're in charge, if we have a position, whether it's an Islamic school or anywhere else, the idea of humility and being able to listen and take on board good suggestions. If I'm outside of that and I see that there's an area of improvement, for me to go over and make those areas, add my suggestions, say what I feel is the right thing to do, as opposed to withholding things. We saw how timely those words of the mu'min were to Musa alayhi salam. Another thing to keep in mind. Some people get very frustrated if they give a good idea and it's not immediately taken on board. I've thought about this. I planned. I spent time on this. I mentioned this. And then I mentioned it to the mu'mineen or those who are in charge, whatever I'm talking about. And those people don't immediately take it on board. Sometimes people get frustrated. They look, what happened? Right? Well, if our work is for the sake of God, and we see ourselves, our success, and the success of other people, then we share our opinions. We're like the mu'min who came to Musa, we share it. If it's taken on board or not taken on board, it's not important. This is important for us wherever we are, even in our personal relationships. Sometimes people get frustrated in their personal relationships. Let's say there's a husband and wife, and they've been struggling with an issue for some time. And the wife has been telling the husband, for instance, that we need to do this particular thing. But let's say he's in charge, and it's his responsibility, and she tells him, she reminds him, she comes up with a good idea, but he doesn't listen to it. How frustrated should we get? Or it's a husband, or it's a child, or there's all these different situations. Getting frustrated is a bit of a problem. I remember hearing once that there was a woman, and she was talking to one of her friends, and she said, I'm getting married for the fourth time. And so her friend told her, she was like, you're getting married for the fourth time? Wow, congratulations. I'm almost afraid to ask, but what happened to your first husband? She said, my first husband, he ate poisonous mushrooms and he died. She said, oh, wow, that's terrible. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. What happened to your second husband? She said, oh, he ate poisonous mushrooms too and he died. She said, well, what about your third husband? I'm almost afraid to ask. She said, no, he died of a broken neck. She said, why did he die of a broken neck? He said, he wouldn't eat mushrooms. So what happens? We let that frustration build up. You're saying something, suggesting something. People don't listen. It's natural. People don't always listen. The idea is offering. The idea is sharing. The idea is putting it out there, like that mu'min of Ali Firon. And our schools, I mentioned schools before, our schools do need improvement, right? What they do in other communities, what they do in some of the other communities where we have strong Muslim schools is that, for instance, when a Muslim school graduate, Muslim students graduates from that school and they go to the best universities, they announce this. This year, our graduating class, who's going to which school? Right? Again, this gives reinforcement to those parents who might have been thinking about participating, that the best schools, our students were able to go. So then the students who are there, them going, and the idea that I'm fighting for the rest of the Muslims. Our schools have to be excellent. Those people who are involved, putting their time, their energy, their children inside the schools. There's room for improvement, and we have to talk about that, but another time, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, what I'd like to talk about today is verse number 21. So the context of the story is that now that mu'min has come to Musa, told Musa that they're plotting to kill you, it's time to leave. So how does Musa respond? What does Musa do? This one has very important reminders for us about one of our most powerful weapons, the weapon of dua, dua and effort. One time, Imam al-Ridha, they said that he used to say this, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. He would say a lot, many times. He would repeat this statement to the mu'mineen. He would say, "Alaykum bisalahul anbiya," that you should hold fast to the weapon of the prophets. What is the weapon of the prophets? A dua, dua. So let's look at the verse. فَخَرَجَ مِنْهَا خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبْ. Musa left. He left the city fearful, vigilant. قَالَ رَبِّ نَجِّنِي مِنَ الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. He said, Allah, save me from these oppressive people. Al-Qawm al-Zalimeen. So a couple of things about this part of the verse. One of the things that it shows us is that Musa alayhi salam didn't feel that he had committed a crime or done a sin by hitting that member of Bani Israel, of the people of Fir'aun. Right? He's saying, they're zalim for coming after me. The authorities are going to kill me for this. They're zalim. Allah, save me from these zalimeen. And when he left, Musa, they said, didn't even have an animal to ride on. Just running. Now again, let's make this a little bit more realistic for us to see the power of dua and what this Nabi did and how we can learn. We learn from some of the books of history, it seems that the Egyptians had a very sophisticated civilization. Very powerful military, for instance. They must have had a good security apparatus. And they're looking for Musa. There's one time when the authorities are looking for you, but they don't know exactly who you are. Another time, the city's on lockdown. Nobody gets in, nobody gets out, and they knew exactly who you are. Your description, we learned from some of the hadith that Musa was a tall, wheat-colored, curly-haired youth. Imam Sadiq tells us this, right? So they know exactly how he looks, who he is, and everybody in the city is looking for him. And now Musa is supposed to escape. And what does he do? He leaves the city and he's making these dua that, oh Allah, save me from these people. Whereas we might tell Musa, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell. How could you possibly get out? They're all looking for you. The city's on lockdown. But Musa's able to do that. So with us, one of our weapons, one of the things that can make us extremely powerful, brothers and sisters, many of us, and I'm speaking to myself, we haven't tapped on our potential yet. We're able to do a lot more as followers of the Ahlul Bayt than we think we're capable of. And by the way, it's not an excuse for me to say, as a follower of Ahlul Bayt, I'm in America, and America, for instance, is a place where there's corruption and facade, and we can't do it. We can't expect those lawful spiritual aspirations from ourselves. Actually, no, that's absolutely not an excuse. If you look at the Islamic Republic of Iran, right? At the Islamic Republic of Iran, that used to be a terrible place before the revolution. Those youth who we're now so inspired by, and we hear their stories, and we're like, how could anybody be like this? If you look and see the situation in Iran before that, absolutely terrible. Lebanon, we're inspired for us. We're living here in the West. We're inspired by what we see with Hezbollah, with their success, now fighting in Syria and helping brothers in Iraq, and right, all of these different things. But when you look at Lebanon, that's where people went to party. Lebanon was corrupt. Why am I saying that? The reminder for all of us that it's no excuse. If I don't see myself advancing spiritually, I can't say the blame is I'm not in a religious society. No. What about all the other mu'mineen and mu'minat? Where did they do? How did they do it? So we can advance spiritually. We can get to those places that we want to do by acting on what we know. So one of the things for us, again now, going back to some of the ahadith, one of them is that God gives instructions to Musa about this weapon. He says, Musa, Ya Musa, ittakhidhni junnatan lishada'id. Musa, you take me, God, as your shield in difficulties. You take me as your shield in difficulties. You're going through difficult situations. Again, it's dua and effort, though. By the way, it's both, right? Because sometimes either will fall into one of the two extremes. Either I forget the role of dua and the idea that God has power over everything. So it's all on me. I'm worried. I'm stressed. Whereas the believer doesn't need to be stressed. God's going to help me. God's going to make it happen for me. I take him as my shield. Right? So I'm worried and I'm stressed because I'm thinking as if it's all on my shoulders. Whereas if I know the Islamic perspective, I do my part no matter how difficult the situation is, and God will provide me with help. The hadith tell us that whatever extent your difficulty is, to that extent, the divine help descends. What's the task you're undertaking right now? What are you supposed to do? Right? But now, so that's one part. Or the other part of, I'll just make dua. I'll sit back and relax, and I'll just make dua, and then inshallah, God will take care of my problems. So I blame it on God. Right? Whereas the Islamic way is that balance. Dua, it's all in God's hands, but God gives instructions. So for instance, in the Quran it says, وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا. Whoever God, whoever has taqwa of Allah, whoever does their responsibility, whoever submits to Allah, this person, Allah will make a way out for them. I'm in a difficult situation. I've been dealing with this for years, this problem, this issue, a relationship issue. My children are far from myself. We're not close in our family. My job situation, whatever it is, I've been dealing with this for a long time. What are God's instructions? Even let's say there's a housewife And she has big dreams. Let's say, for instance, let's say there was a woman. She's a housewife. She's not earning. She's a housewife. That's her responsibility. She's doing it. And she says, look, I'd like to travel, make ziyarah. But right now, financially, I don't have the means. What is the way of this person? How can they tap into those secrets? Two things that they require from us. One is dua, and the other is effort. Whatever I'm doing, my effort, if I had money, my effort would be to put aside money. If I don't have money, all right, whatever little I can. Right? So even let's say in that situation where a sister says, I'd like to make hajj. That's my dream, to go to the house of God. Right? But I don't have the money to do that. Dua, and then whatever effort she can do. Even if that means, because I'm not working, doesn't mean I'm going to quit being a housewife and go to work. No. That effort, then she can make that dua. If she does that, then the verse comes true. Right? Whoever has taqwa, Allah will make a way out for them. So it's not about being lazy. Right? If I'm working on my relationship with my spouse, for instance, I haven't been as close to my spouse as I should be. Now I'm making dua for that change, but what about my behavior? Have I become kinder? And then with taqwa, it doesn't just mean I do good deeds at one time and then I expect that immediately God will provide results. No, effort, continuous effort, taqwa. Right? So what I want to do is, well, in any situation, identify what my responsibility is and then focus on that. It's not about cheating. It's not about finding shortcuts. It's not about believing in the supernatural and then not doing my physical responsibility. They said once that one of the Anbiya, Imam Sadiq tells us this. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Once one of the Anbiya fell ill. One of the Anbiya became sick. And this Nabi, when he became sick, he said that he was speaking to God. He says that, well, he was speaking and he said, La atadawa hatta yakuna alladhi amradani huwa alladhi yashfini. He says, I'm not going to take any medicine until the person who made me sick cures me. I'm not going to take any medicine. I'm not going to do my responsibility. I'll sit back, let God cure me. God's the one who made me sick. I'll sit back until God. And then what did God tell him? So God gave him wahi, and he says that I will not give you shifa, la ashfiq, I won't give you shifa until you take that medicine. And the shifa is from me. Right? So when I'm doing my responsibility, it's not that I believe the medicine saving me. No, it's God. But my duty is to do my part. Right? So we want to look and see whatever that responsibility is. Right? Another point we learn from Musa. When Musa got this information, right, he immediately took steps. He left the city. He didn't wait. Immediately he left the city. One of the things that we learn from the Urafa is the idea of acting on our what we can see. Right? On the information that's at our disposal. You get trustworthy information from inside the castle of Pharaoh that they're planning to kill you, immediately you move. Not dreams, for instance. There's some of the mu'mineen, if they have a dream, that inspires them. I'll change my direction based on a dream. Right? Well, we don't base life on dreams. We base life on what we can see. Practical responsibility, taqwa, what does God require from me at this time? If we do that, though, we're invincible. If we do that with the help of Allah, we are invincible. I remember once my uncle was telling me, I heard that my uncle saw a fight. Right? There was a fight that was about to happen. And he's watching, and two cars crash into one another. You know how you see road rage here, right? Two cars crashed into one another. And two guys get out of the car. And one of them is a little guy. And one of them is like one of these big, you know, like football player size guys, right? He gets out of the car too. So the little guy, apparently it was the little guy's fault. He had hit the bigger guy, his car, right? So the big guy comes over there to teach the little guy a lesson. And he said that the little guy went over and he went down into a kung fu stance. Ready, right? And the big guy saw that. And the big guy just turned around, went back into the car and left, right? So, with the help of God, you do your part. You're a little guy, right? But you do your part. I'm going for a job interview. I'm doing my part is important, right? Doing what God wants from me is important. With that, then that's enough, right? I do my part. I trust in God. I trust God's timing. That's another one that's a little bit important, right? Let me not tell God when it's supposed to happen. I'm like Musa. I leave the city. I say, God save me. But I don't teach God. We have a hadith that tell us not to teach God when we're making dua. Don't tell God what's supposed to happen. You know, I need this, and I needed it yesterday, God, right? Or, you know, in a more respectful way, we don't, right? We're trusting in him. He knows better. The hadith says this. It says, O son of Adam, obey me in the commands I've given. وَلَا تُعَلِّمُنِي مَا يُصْلِحُكَ. Don't teach me what's good for you, right? Sometimes God's wise. He knows. He wants what's best for us. He cares about us more than we care about ourselves. They said once there was this elderly couple. They were both 60 years old, and they were celebrating their 35th anniversary. And an angel came over to them and said that, you know what? You've been such good people that I'm going to grant you each a wish. And so the wife said, you know, I'd like to travel all around the world. And the angel went poof. And she had tickets in her hands. And she was going to be able to go on a cruise ship and travel around the world. And then her husband, he said, well, what do you want? He said, I wish I had a wife who was 30 years younger. And then the angel said, poof, and he was 90. Right? Sometimes all du'as aren't necessarily in our favor. It's not necessary. God knows better. We don't want to teach God, tell God how it's supposed to be. Then we do our part. God knows. He cares. That's the whole point of... Now, another thing we learn from the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, these rules now for the du'a, is the idea of, now forgive my language, using God's kindness against him. Using God's kindness against him. For instance, we're told in the ahadith, they say that when your heart breaks, it might happen, right? You're praying, you've been struggling with something for a long time. You're going through difficulty, you're begging God, pleading, I need assistance, I need help. Sometimes what will happen is the tears will start to roll down your face. The hadith from the imam says that you take that seriously, right? He says, when a servant is in the state of sajda, and his tears start to flow, the mercy descends. So take advantage of that by making du'as and requests. Right? So if you feel that state, it might happen in the month, the days of Ramadan, that we're really feeling that closeness to Allah, or just I'm at the breaking point. At that time, tears start to flow, now is the time to make du'a. More than that, we learn from the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt, they say that there's a way of getting God to answer your du'as. They say what you do is first you start off with salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Then after that, when you end your du'as, again you say salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The secret the Ahlul Bayt teach us is this, that both of those du'as, of you asking for mercy on Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, those are answered prayers. So what the imams tell you to do is slip your prayer in between. Right? They said that God is too kind. He'll answer the first prayer, answer the second part of the prayer. Your little tiny prayer in between, why will he? Right? So you have to use God's kindness in that way and make sure that you do for that. The other thing the Ahlul Bayt tell us is not being afraid to pray for things, big or little. Right? We want to get ourselves to that true state of tawheed where I believe the world is in God's control. I don't control anything, not even drinking water. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-aliyy al-azim. I want to get to that stage of seeing that the world is in, nobody controls the world, not the powers of the world. Brothers and sisters, there are some of the mu'mineen whose faith has become so great, they will say those ayat about God blocking them from their enemies and walk out in front of an enemy. Okay, we can get to these stages. I want to give you some stories later on, right? So it's just a matter of increasing that amount of faith. So how can I increase that? One of the ways is making dua for everything. God told Musa, he said, even for the salt in your food, you ask. You want to give grass to your sheep, you ask. It's all in God's hands. Don't only, some people, they make a mistake. You know, the little things, you know, like, I got that, God. You know, the bigger things. No, that's not the way it's supposed to be. With everything we pray for, the little things and the big things. Actually, we're told in the hadith that the more we ask, the more that God appreciates. فَإِنَّ أَحَبَّ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ إِلَى اللَّهِ تَعَالَىٰ أَسْأَلُهُمْ. The believers that God loves the most are those believers who pray and ask for everything. Now, the other thing that we're told in the Ahadith is one of them is praying with expectancy, but also praying for big things, important things. Not only things that for us seem achievable, right? Big things. For instance, a man once came to the presence of the Holy Prophet, and he told the Prophet, he said that, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He told the Prophet, he said that, I was your host in Ta'if before, right? Let's say before the Prophet became a prophet, the Prophet went to visit Ta'if, and this individual had been the host of the Prophet, and then now he sees the Prophet has announced his prophethood, and I've done him a favor back in the day, so now I want to see the Prophet. So he came to the Prophet, and he says that, I was your host. So the Prophet gave him this wonderful opportunity. He said, ask me for something. And the guy said, I know what I want. He said, I want 80 sheep and some shepherds to take care of the sheep. He said, the Prophet put his head down. Maybe the Prophet was disappointed. He said, okay, you can have that. Then he said, I wish this man had made dua like the old woman of Bani Israel. And he said, who is that ajuz of Bani Israel? So the Prophet started to tell the story. He said that when Musa had gotten the command to leave Egypt, and now he's running and leaving. And remember, Pharaoh and his army are chasing Musa. So up in front of Musa is the sea. Behind Musa is the army of Pharaoh. The companions of Musa start to say that we're going to definitely be overcome. What can we do? So Musa goes and he asks for revelation. What should we do? And he's told, he says that what you need to do is to get the body of Yusuf, the bones of Yusuf, take that with you. Musa, Yusuf should go with you. So he says, okay, alhamdulillah. Now, where is the grave of Yusuf? And he asks amongst the mu'mineen. One of the people said, if anybody knows it's this old woman, she would know where Yusuf is buried. So Musa went over, found the old lady. Look, Pharaoh's coming. The sea needs to open. Come, tell me where the body of Yusuf is. She said that I won't tell you where the body of Yusuf is unless you promise me to give me my request. So Musa, yeah, that's fine. Can you just tell me? We got to go, okay? So she said that my request is that I be with you in paradise at your rank. I want to be in paradise with you. Now I have my opportunity. Now I have one of the Anbiya of Allah. He needs me. I want big things. I want to go to paradise and I want to be at your rank. They said, Musa, at this stage, start to try to negotiate with him. Okay. In my own words, can you just ask for paradise? I can do paradise. But you want to be one of the Ulul Azm prophets at my rank? And God gave wahi. He says that, don't worry, Musa. You tell her that you will have that. And we won't bring you down even one iota. You'll both be at the same level. So the Prophet, after he was telling the story, he says that, why didn't he ask for this? Why not ask for big things when we're praying? Now, the last part is something which is special for you, brothers and sisters. In addition to all of that, you guys also have, all of us have, we have the Ahlul Bayt on our side. We have the Ahlul Bayt who can do these miracles, meaning because of their position with God, nobody has power independent of Allah, but because of their position with God, because of how much God cares about them, not only you making dua, but asking Allah by the right of these individuals, and then it's just how much you want these things. Brothers and sisters, there's been people, you've heard that Isa alayhi salam brought the dead back to the living, right? I've met people like that. Brought back to life by the Ahlul Bayt. Let me just tell you the story of one of these people. Who was serving as one of the khadims of the haram of Imam al-Ridha, alayhi salam. So this individual is telling his story. He says that when I was younger, I wasn't very religious. I was wealthy, came from a rich family, wealthy, but I wasn't very religious. This man developed cancer. So obviously we've got money, we'll take care of it, we'll handle it. They start to go to all of the doctors in the Islamic Republic, and nobody can give an answer. No way of arresting the cancer. It's too advanced, you're going to die. Well, we've got money, we'll go outside. We'll go to America, we'll find the best hospitals. They go to America. Again, nobody can provide an answer. You've got a few months to live, bro, go head back. And this guy goes back to his family. So now he knows he's about to die. He said that a strange thing happened at this time. He says that I started to become more peaceful with everybody. Sometimes when we know that death is approaching, right, our heart, we become a little bit more latif. He says, for instance, children would be making noise in the house. They'd be shouting, they'd be running. It wouldn't bother me as much. I'm gonna die soon, what difference does it make? Sometimes when we get that feeling of being close to death, actually we enjoy life more. The things that really count, those things, they matter, I'm able to enjoy. So he said that his heart got a little softer in this way. He says that he wasn't really a believer, a mu'min or anything like that. His mother told him, he said, why don't you go to Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam and ask for shafa? So he said that I wasn't a mu'min, I wasn't really a strong believer, but I said, look, my mother's old. She would like it. Why hurt her feelings? I'll go. He says, when they start to take him into the courtyard, he started to feel something was happening. He said, when they were taking them there, he said, stop for a second. I want to make wudu. He stopped. He started to make that wudu, and now he's going towards the shrine of the imam. He started to smell a wonderful smell. Some of the people who were around him started to smell this wonderful smell too, but then he saw the dhari open, the dhari of the imam open, and he sees the imam now. When he sees the imam, and he's in, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. He goes over to the imam and he tells the imam, he says, the imam says, what's the problem? He says, I'm sick. He says, stand. And the man is able to stand. That was his cure. He stood up. And now I'm cured, I'm healthy. He says he then wanted to thank the imam. The imam starts to turn away from him. The imam starts to walk away from him. He wants to run after the imam, to get over to the imam, to thank him. And the imam won't stop. The imam's moving. So finally he told the imam, he said, by the right of Al-Jawad, stop. He had heard that from his mother before. The imam was attached to Imam Al-Jawad. He said, by the right of Jawad, stop. And the imam stopped. He said, what happened? He said that I wanted to kiss your hand for giving me shafa. He said, I didn't do it for you, I did it for your mother. Go kiss her hand. So brothers and sisters, we have this ability, we have the Ahlul Bayt on our side, we have God on our side. We don't need to be living a life not able to overcome our problems and issues. No, dua and effort. By the way, our biggest and our greatest dua is the dua for the return of the Imam of the time. Let's not get tired of craving for a savior. We ask Allah by the right of Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad to hasten the reappearance. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. We ask Him to hasten the reappearance of our Master. We ask Him to provide relief for the mustad'afin, the mu'mineen, those poor people, the people who are suffering, Muslims all over the world. We ask that Allah provide them with relief. We ask that Allah make us part of that relief by changing ourselves, reforming ourselves, becoming those true soldiers of the Imam. We ask that Allah provide help and assistance for the mujahideen, the mu'mineen, the ulama, maraja, and especially the leader. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.